Peter R. Bregan, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
Hi, my wonderful, wonderful audience. My last two shows I've begun, and that wonderful introduction starts. And last time it was my guest who was fidgeting, and then my wife Ginger just got concerned about how I'm placed and whether it was right or not. And I'm there sort of motioning her off the screen. You look, if you're on the TV, which you will be if you're watching tomorrow, this is the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour. We start every Wednesday at 4 p.m. with the live radio. And then that is, thanks to wonderful PRN and to my engineer, I know he calls himself an engineer, Alex, who is handling this. We are also Skype videoed. And that becomes the TV show of me and my guests. And it just has been working beautiful. We're having viewers in the thousands on the TV, and the radio is keeping up and doing as well as ever. And it's just a lot of fun for me. So welcome my wonderful audience. Welcome anybody who's new. I'm Peter Bregan. I'm a psychiatrist. And I love everything I do. I love seeing my patients. I love talking with you. I love the videos we have on YouTube and my tremendously large website, Bregan.com, and my written, I never talk about myself at the start of the show, but I feel inspired, and my more than 20 books, and I don't know, maybe getting up to 90 scientific articles now. I am often very pleased, in fact, I'm always very pleased to have my guests on, the people who consent to be on this show are always wonderful people, and so I'm stuck with hyperboles of description, but my guest today is just really incredible, and you're going to see what a dedicated to service, wonderful human being she is. Her name is Mary Neal Vieten. Mary Neal Vieten. And I want to spell her last name for you. It's V-I-E-T-E-N. V-I-E-T-E-N. And you can Google her and you can get to her website. She's a clinical psychologist. She's a commander, now retired in the U.S. Navy. She's been on several deployments, two major deployments to Iran and Iraq, Iraq, to that dreadful region of the world. One of her accomplishments is educating 1,000 ministers in the U.S. Navy, chaplains, in trauma and related work. She's got a private practice in Southern Maryland, and you can, where she works with the military, police, ordinary citizens, but she kind of specializes in people who have been through trauma, and I'll let her tell you more about that. And she is the founder of War Fighters. I mean, this is such an important and wonderful thing. And I hope today in the many things Warfighters Advance, and many things we might talk about today, I hope to get to the news about the surprise, the supposed surprise, at least, that in fact many of the rockets that Iran fired at us in recent times did in fact hit the general targets and demolish buildings. They did not inflict direct wounds on our soldiers, but dozens of them develop concussions. So perhaps we'll get to talk about that. Mary, welcome to the show. You've been on the radio, but now I have you for TV. So relax and flash that wonderful smile and introduce yourself. Perhaps talk about Warfighters Advance.
Thank you for having me. Warfighter Advance is my favorite subject, of course, so I could talk till 4 a.m. without probably even drawing breath about that topic. But I appreciate you having us and giving us this opportunity.
Oh, you're just so welcome. So how long has Warfighters Advance been there? How'd you get to create it?
We first started running it in its current form in the fall of 2014. And basically, it was just an effort of a number of post-deployment veterans and myself who realized that we just couldn't continue down the road that we were on as far as treating trauma like it was a medical issue and that it would somehow respond to some sort of chemical intervention.
Well, and this is something, of course, that's very, very dear to my heart. I wrote a book chapter and a book by lawyers for lawyers on how to defend and support and advocate for military personnel and vets. And when I looked at the concussions, which are really traumatic brain injury from mild to severe, it looked to me like a perfect storm because they would, I guess virtually always, you could tell better than me, that they have not only traumatic brain injury, but they have post-traumatic stress reactions. You and I probably together don't like to call them disorders. They're the reactions of normal, wonderful young men and women to trauma and not disorders or diseases. And then giving the drug, especially the antidepressants, but really any neurotoxin, giving any neurotoxin to somebody with, oh God, not only PTSD or PTS, but on top of that, a head injury. So let me let you talk more now. My style is to listen more. So tell us more about Warfighters. You know, we don't have to have a conversation at the start.
So we are a 7-day program, and our goal is to take either people who do not want to go into the psychiatric pipeline and be drugged, or people who have already been funneled into that pipeline and are drugged. We help them to find ways to cope with trauma that are more scientific and more realistic and more likely to get them a good outcome. So they come to our program everyone that comes to our program, I should say first, is a self-referral. So we are so non-medical that we don't even want a referral from the doctor. If the person feels like they need to be there, then we accept that they need to be there. And so they sign up on their own recognizance and are welcomed into the program. We open every one of our 7-day evolutions with a gala dinner, so that we're just screaming at them from the first moment, this is not the hospital. And so politicians even come to the opening dinners. We have state senators and delegates, the mayor of the town almost always shows up, and then people, executives from the base. And some of the local defense contractors also come to the dinner to well wish the newest participants, you know, on their journey. And then we spend the week together and we dismantle the medical model for them in a way that anyone can understand why what they have is not a medical problem and that a medical response is not going to help them to get down the road. And by the end of the week, they are thoroughly educated in what it's going to take for them to manage any trauma symptoms or other challenges, pain challenges, for example, or concussion challenges, what's going to be healthy and what's going to actually help them to get where they're trying to go. So it's a rewarding week. It's about 96 hours of programming. It's exhausting. But we do everything sort of military style. People understand that. And so one of the things we know about military members is when they have a problem, they want the field manual, which is basically the book that says how to solve the problem. And so what we do over the 96 hours is we lay out the field manual for how to cope with trauma and reintegration.
I'd love to see that. I don't know that I've ever seen your field manual, and it'd be wonderful if you get a chance to send it to me, if that's allowed, email it or mail it.
Sure.
You are very aggressively telling the truth. Do you get much blowback?
You know, it's really, really interesting. A lot of people ask me that, especially when I go and give talks, because, you know, I'll lay it out to the molecular level, you know, why this can't work. And The only pushback I ever get is every once in a while, a psychiatrist will come up to me after a talk and say, why did you tell them that?
You know, why did you tell them that? Because it's the truth.
Some version of why did you tell them that the emperor has no clothes?
Yeah.
And, but no one's ever come up and said, you're wrong. And I'm suspecting that that's because I'm not wrong. And I don't mean that in an arrogant way. I don't ever present my opinions when I talk in public. I lay out the science and let people decide for themselves. And I really do encourage them to check my work. You know, please go and look up everything I say, because I'm not afraid that they're going to find that I'm wrong.
Do you do like a PowerPoint presentation about the drugs and things like that?
Sometimes I do. It depends on what I'm being asked to do. Sometimes people will ask me to come and do a lecture specifically on informed consent for psychiatric medications, for example, or specifically on trauma and responses to trauma. And of course, I never miss a chance to say what you shouldn't do in addition to what you should do. And
folks, we're going to get to talk about the informed consent, because Mary tells me that this is her favorite topic, and it's so critical. But tell me, can you give us an idea, maybe with a story of a soldier? You could make one up as you go along or disguise one. I wish I'd talked to you about this in advance, but to tell a story, give us an idea of what somebody goes through and what is your ideal outcome?
Sure. I can do that. I'll tell you two. I'll tell you one that was very positive and one that was very negative. Because sometimes, because of the level and intensity of the drugging, sometimes people actually get into our program, it's already too late for them. So one example is we had an Army staff sergeant who, when he joined our program, he was on 8 psychiatric medications, and he was on what's called terminal leave, which means that he had finished except for kind of burning up his end vacation. But he was done in the Army. He only had a couple weeks left. But he was on 8 psychiatric medications, and he was homeless. He was actually living in his car.
And they're just discharging him.
Well, they didn't know. The psychiatrist never doesn't ask those questions. They ask you if you're sleeping or if you're having nightmares. They don't ask you if you have a house, you know, to live in. So,
you know, folks, psychiatrists, my colleagues, are just about the stupidest people on earth right now. And I'm going to do a blog. Look for a 9X blog, unless it gets shut down. It's going to be on why, you know, it's just too dangerous to go to psychiatrists anymore.
Yeah.
And this man, this young man, I'm presuming he's pretty young, you know, to be in that situation. Well, how can you possibly even begin to? I was wondering how you could approach withdrawing anybody in a week. Do you actually try to withdraw people?
No, we don't. So this particular young man, he came through our program. He got the information that he needed. And ultimately, you know, one of the things we were able to do, of course, was get a roof over his head and help him get some kind of a job, which, you know, again, we're more.
Duh. Thank God for you. Yes.
So once he had a roof.
Can you hear me? I can't hear you anymore. Folks, we have lost,
over
I believe.
His head.
Okay.
Oh, I can hear you.
We're losing. I lost you for about 30 seconds. We'll either edit that or leave it in as it looks. So keep going. We just lost the last 10 seconds. Seemed like a minute.
Okay. So this young man, we found him a place to live and helped him start to work on his resume. And we also found a physician that would help him to taper, you know, in a rational way. But long story short, this young man is now a graduate student at William & Mary. So these are the kinds of things that can happen. And of course, he's completely drug free. He does not see mental health for anything. But we've had other stories where we had a young Marine who went through the program, and when he came to us, he was on 13 psychiatric medications at the same time. They were all prescribed by the same provider.
13 medications.
Yes, he was falling asleep during the program and drooling on himself, and this is a Marine. And his story was that when he finished his tour in Iraq, he left Iraq on his 2 feet walking and had no physical injuries whatsoever. Walked out into a great job. His roommate, who was also in the Marine Corps with him, committed suicide in their apartment. And that was when he went to the VA and asked for help with his bereavement. And their response was this drugging. And so when he...
So a VA clinic in the U.S.?
Yes.
Had him on 13 psychiatric drugs.
18 at the highest, 13 when we saw him. So,
and it's insane. This is such an important show because I see this, folks. I see it particularly in my malpractice suits, mm-hmm. this ridiculous drugging. I've seen it over the years. I've been in VA suits against the VA where terrible things are done, but it's not so different from clinic practice in psychiatry and private practice in psychiatry.
Yeah. I don't see a difference. But this young man is, by the time he could taper off the drugs, was maimed. So he has neurological problems that are range from being legally blind to being paralyzed.
And, wow.
And there's nothing wrong with him, except that he was just on so much medicine for so long that his brain doesn't function properly anymore.
And has he been able to get off?
He's not on any medications at all.
Oh, great. But he has persistent brain injury. Has he thought about suing the VA?
He doesn't have it together. He has to have a visiting nurse. He can't live independently. So he doesn't have the mental wherewithal to go through that.
Oh, my God. Well, this is going to be an outstanding show in terms of discussing and looking at just how bad it gets. And I've seen people, come to my private practice just decimated in this manner. And there is very little I can do in private practice, maybe help them cut down a little on their medications. But folks like this need residential help to get off their meds. And there's very, very few places that do that. Right. Your program always lasts 1 week.
Mm-hmm.
So you really get them started on big change.
Yeah.
Do you follow up or do you arrange? I know you arrange for follow up, but do you yourselves as an organization, Warfighters Advance, do you follow up?
Yes. So we're a training program. And so at the end of the training program, our graduates join our alumni association, and the alumni association is very, very robust support and follow up. And so, people can talk about anything in that alumni association. We have Facebook and email and phone calling, but, we know everything from when somebody's having a birthday or a baby, to their accomplishments. And if they're struggling, we'll reach out to them and, try to help them out, redirect them.
Oh, that's wonderful. And I imagine the veterans give each other a lot of help on.
Yeah, they do. They
really support. There is no formal organized follow-up program, in part, I would guess, because these people are scattered around the country.
Yes, that's right. We follow up with them in, like I said, social media, and there's some certain areas where they do live together, locally close enough to meet each other, and they certainly do that. But, they both basically go home and plug back into their local communities and their local support, but armed with the information they need to, get on a path that's for health and healing rather than ultimately destruction.
How many folks are you training a year?
Between about 80 and 150. It really depends on how many 7-day cycles we can run. And since we have to fundraise for each one of them separately, it usually becomes a funding issue. We have a waiting list of people that want to go through the program, who want to receive the training. And so as often as we can possibly run one of these programs, we'll put one on the books. So we have two in March coming up. Our 19th and our 20th evolutions are at the beginning and the end of March. So that'll be another 40 to 42 people going through.
Folks, I don't promote even myself for getting funding here, but this is a really wonderful place to give funding. Do you want to give your email for folks?
Yeah, if you are interested in emailing, or if you're interested in just looking at the the website and the donation site, all of those things, it's at warfighteradvance.org. And if you, on warfighteradvance.org, if you go to the tab that says team, everyone on the team is pictured there with their bio and their email address. So you can pick your favorite military miscreant and send them an email.
Mary, on the left side of your face, you're getting a very bright, beautiful sun glare. So, yeah, just moving a little bit is going to do it.
How about that?
Wonderful.
Okay.
Boy, I wish my lighting problems were so easily solved. I've had some Lulus along the way. Now it's just your left shoulder, and that's just, that'll be fine. If it, it may raise up with time, but we're informal here. Are you planning or are you doing any follow-up of a real research nature where you have somebody keeping track of these folks and how they're doing?
Yes. So we follow up with them formally once a month. We call it a buddy check or a recall. And so we go and make sure that everyone is at least doing well. We actually do have a research project going on right now that's fascinating, where we're talking to people in the 2 weeks before they go through the program and asking them very specific questions about their functional status. So, you know, the kind of how their day is, what they're doing with their life, but very functional things, not symptomatic. And then what we're doing is we're asking them similar questions in the 6 weeks after, and then doing a linguistic comparison of how they're not only what they're doing functionally, but even how they're talking about themselves and how they're describing themselves. And we're hoping that even some of the medical language that people use to describe their experiences is beginning to drop out.
And folks, we're talking to Mary Neal Vieten. And Neal is N-E-A-L, and Vieten is V-I-E-T-E-N. Did I get that right? V-I-E-T-E-N. If I had been consulted by you, but I don't think I was, I would have just recommended everything you already thought of. Did you have any familiarity with my work before you began to do this?
Absolutely. What ended up happening to me was, as unlikely as it is, I picked up a copy of Daniel Carlott's book, Unhinged. And this was way back in my early military career, and was just absolutely shocked by the disclosures that he made. And then from there started to sort of pick up different books. And one of the books that ended up coming my way was Your Drug May Be Your Problem. And so that was the first one that just laid it out. And
and that's by myself and social worker David Cohen, Brennan and Cohen.
That's right. And that book has become so influential at Warfighter Advance. I think I've mentioned this to you before. We buy that book by the box.
Yes.
And every single person who goes through the program ends up with a copy of that book. And it's the beauty of it, I think, is not only that it lays everything out, the why don't do this and how to stop, but it also, it's at a language level that just any layman can hang on to, and they can really follow the information.
I have a newer edition, folks. Some of you know, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, a guide for prescribers, therapists, patients, and their families. And I do think that the earlier book, Your Drug May Be Your Problem, I think I was thinking more of lay persons. And with the second book, I was thinking more of the whole team. And they're kind of a little different, and they're both very good books, I think. Well, it's wonderful what you're doing. Anything more about this program that would be helpful for us to know? What are the responses of, I think I could ask you questions for the whole hour about the program. What are the responses of these young men and women when they hear such a shocking presentation that basically they have been had and abused? Do they react that way? We've been had and abused.
Yes. they are angry. They are absolutely angry. And it's one of the things we have to do during the week is kind of process their anger and ask them to turn it into a way forward and not a way to stay angry. But you know, and to use it constructively and to use it, as we say, now that you know this, you become a force multiplier. It's a, you know, another military term, but it means, you know, they go home and they can tell others and they can spread the word and share their book. And so, you know, we try to take that anger and turn it into something positive, but they are very, very angry once it's broken down. And because when they came to us, they believe wholeheartedly that they have a condition. And if they just follow the psychiatrist's or the doctor's prescribing long enough, they're just going to wake up one day and they're not going to have PTSD anymore. And they just believe in that so thoroughly.
Oh, that I hadn't imagined anything so tragic and misleading. And
yeah, it's awful. They have it. They, you know, they get told, you know, you have this chemical imbalance and it's because of, you know, what you've been through, and you're going to have to take these pills for the rest of your life. And if we just find the right chemistry, everything will get right again. And, you know, it's absolutely tragic. And when they realize that they cannot get there from here, you know, they're more than happy to, you know, do the hard work of getting off the medicine and doing something else. They just didn't know.
So they don't have much advanced warning as they're coming in. Do they know it's basically a non-drug approach or non-medical and just don't realize how bad it is?
Yes. So we're very clear on our website how we deal with all of this stuff. But also, you know,
but who can grasp that until they hear it said?
No, you can't. So when they come to us, they have heard about the program almost inevitably by someone who's already been through it. And so they're looking for an answer that does not involve medication. And so someone will tell them, I think I found it. You need to go there too. And they'll send them. But I think you're right. I think it's really hard for them to grasp. Maybe they can grasp that medicine is not helping, but the depth of the lies that they have been told and the story they've been sold, there's no way they could know that was a real thing.
Yeah, that's interesting. See, my practice, which is I keep relatively small now, 2 days a week, and with a little bit of relaxation, very much self-selected by the people who call and say, I know your work. And the people who don't know my work and call me, I call them back. And usually it takes one or two messages and I leave a message, check my website first. So I don't have that intense experience of people coming in and being totally dismayed. Have you usually read something of mine, gone on the website, really all the time, because if they haven't, I let them know, because I don't want them coming and having a shock.
Right.
I don't want them coming and being misled either. So people come to see me know what's going to happen. And this is a very stunning to hear. I can really imagine. And I'm sure that's very painful for you to see people so betrayed. It must just make your heart sink. And of course, these are people you love automatically because they're your military, they're your comrades, and they're young, and they're wounded. I imagine it makes your heart sick some of the time because you've got 1 week, and as you said, some of them are damaged permanently. It must make you sad at times.
It does. It can be. It's kind of a heavy, you know. There's a heaviness that goes along with it. But you know, then you know, at the end of the week, when you see people just determined to turn their life around, and you see the alumni, you know, that come out and reach out to them and say, "Hey, we're here to support you, and this is going to be different." I mean, we see the outcomes, and they're amazing. You know, they're absolutely amazing what these young men and women do with their lives once they're drug free.
Yeah. We may not get to cover everything today, but that would be wonderful. So we'll get John back on to talk about a lot of these things. Because as I'm talking with you, new ideas occur to me that I think people would be interested in. I don't think I've thought of asking you this before, but I mean, what would it be like to make this a civilian program, two programs, if you had the energy? or with someone else developing a civilian program based on this model, do you think that would work without the people already being in a mode that they're, you know, that they have so much in common, such enormous things in common as military people?
We actually talk about this sometimes, is, you know, if we did it for civilians, what is the glue that would hold them together? You know, we once in a while we'll let paramilitary people, so police or firefighters, that kind of thing, have someone from that occupation go through the program, and they bond with us in the same way because it's just so similar, you know.
Yeah, it's uniformed services.
Yeah, exactly. So from that standpoint, I don't know how it would go, and what would be the glue that held it together, except maybe the level of betrayal, you know, that. But we talk about it sometimes, and of what would happen if we tried to do this with a civilian audience. And it's an experiment you just have to do and see what happens.
I don't know anything about your religious background, but it could be organized around Judaism. It could be organized around Christianity.
Sure.
So that you had people who shared a belief in God or, a belief in love in a spiritual way, a bonding of people.
Actually, it's a very interesting slant on it.
Yeah, I have, since my earliest days, I thought and I hoped that Jewish organizations and Christian organizations would come to me and say, you know, speak to us. We can do this through our synagogue, through our churches. And I don't believe a single Jew, even though I'm Jewish, Jewish organization has ever come to me in that way. But numerous times I've been invited to get involved in one way or another with Christian organizations around this. I had a couple of interesting presentations and conferences that I did with evangelical Christians who believed that their churches should be providing all the services that mental hospitals and clinics did. Mm-hmm. And they developed an international organization of biblical counselors, and I talked with them a few times. And that provides one kind of base that I love consulting with and talking to them about why they shouldn't be taking the psych drugs. They know that intuitively, but they may need an outside person, a psychiatrist, to come in and tell them that. So this show would be an invitation for me. Are you interested in consulting with any groups like that?
Sure, absolutely. I'm always interested in getting the message out because it's just so important that the carnage is getting to be unreal.
Well, folks, Commander Mary Veeton, Mary Neal Veeton, and Peter R. Bregan here. We'd love independently and maybe even together someday, I don't know what the future holds, to consult with you about programs that you could sponsor if you especially had something cohesive that you felt people would share in common. Training programs like this, but there's a lot of fear about trying things like this out there, a lot of fear.
Yes.
Tell me about that. I mean, how courageous did you have to be to do this?
I think you have to be courageous on two levels. One of them is that I think there's actually personal risk for someone who wants to take on the pharmaceutical industry. Yes. Even if you're just standing up there telling the truth, eventually they're going to get mad.
It's if you are standing up there.
Which I am. They're going to get mad. They're going to notice you. I mean, I think right now I'm a fly on the wall, you know, in terms of their billion-dollar industry. But I think there is some personal risk. The other thing that is really, really hard to explain to people is why what we're doing is not medical. Because people's feelings and emotions have been medicalized to the point where if somebody tells you their story, suddenly you're doing something medical by listening. And so we've had to work very, very hard to make sure that everything we do is, the language is just airtight, that this is training, those are stories. We are not treating illness. We don't have HIPAA. And, you know, and the releases, the media releases and all the stuff that we have to put together to make sure that our training can be given is it's also a risk there. So,
yeah. Well, you told me when we first talked, and it's come up again, that your favorite topic is informed consent. So let's talk about informed consent for neurotoxins. And how do you do informed consent for neurotoxins? I'm gonna keep the mic open for you on this one, Mary.
So it's really an interesting thing. So we have in the morning at Warfighter, at the 7 day, every morning we have a series of lectures. And I do the informed consent lecture. It's broken up into 3 2-hour time segments. And in all honesty, in those 6 hours during the week, I can give them barely the minimum that they need to make an informed decision. But what I try to do during that time is, because they were not informed before they submitted to psychiatric care or took the medication, which are two separate things. So I try to make sure that I break down the industry itself so they understand the diagnostic and statistics manual. You know, they understand how an emotion becomes a disease, you know, just like how a bill becomes a law. You know, we walk through that process so that they can really understand that it's not medical, not valid, not reliable. I go through all those concepts. And then we break down the interview process and all the different ways that that can go wrong, and the labeling process and all the ways that that can go wrong, and just attack it from all different directions, and then eventually get to the point where we're talking about the individual classes of drugs, and these are the absolute basic, most basic things you need to know about taking a neuroleptic or taking an antidepressant or taking a benzodiazepine. So, you know, just the absolute basics. So in all of this, you can imagine 6 hours is barely enough to contain it all. We talk about the National Institutes of Mental Health and how they've rejected the diagnostic manual. There's little, you know, some films we throw in there to make sure everything is real clear. But at the end of it, usually about halfway through it, we have people starting to get very, very angry, because we even lay out the Department of Defense and the Veterans Administration's regulations on informed consent. So we have put those up on the screen and we review them. And, you know, everybody to a man says, I didn't get that. That did not happen to me. And so what we find is that over the course of those 6 hours, and with all of the other things that we provide as options, because informed consent also involves alternatives. And so we have 1 hour classes on all these different alternatives. And what we find is that once people realize what is actually going on, we don't have to tell them you shouldn't do this. They realize it themselves. And they just withdraw their informed consent, or they withdraw their consent. Now that they have the information they need. So it's not a matter of us, you know, chasing them home and saying, you shouldn't do this. They know they shouldn't do it, and they know why.
What do they run into when they leave in terms of finding somebody to help them withdraw?
It's very nearly impossible. That's one of the hardest things, and we prepare them for that. We prepare them with, that's one of the reasons they get a copy of your book. Because at the very least, they can take that book to their provider and, you know, point to the page and the drug they're on and say, hey, you know, help me. And this is how, this is one way to do it. We provide them with some internet sources. We provide them with Laura Delano's website, you know, some things that we have vetted pretty carefully so that they can have that discussion. Sometimes the help them. they just say, absolutely not getting involved. I believe in your chemical imbalance and you need to be on these drugs, so I'm not going to help you. So it is a very difficult road for a lot of people once they get home to find someone to support them.
How many folks, percentage-wise, very roughly, do you think manage to come off their meds?
I don't know of anyone in our program who has not come off them.
Oh, my gosh.
I know of two people that where the veterans...
Oh, my. Tell me, how does this happen? Do they just do it on their own with
I don't know. Maybe they're just military. No, I'm just kidding. I know of two people that very sadly that during the process, they got off the medication, and when they hit some sort of an emotional hard spot, the psychiatrist talked them into reintroducing.
Sure. But that's so small a number. Yeah. So they're getting off by themselves, picking up as they can, whatever help some practitioner is going to give them.
Yes. And again, they do, we ask them not to do that without medical supervision. So,
of course, you have to do that.
Right. And so what we're pretty, that's why we give them so much information that they can take to their provider. And we tell them, if your provider won't help you, find another provider. The answer is not to give up on...
Even a psychotherapist, I think it's time to say that actually the most stupid people in the world about psychiatric drugs are psychiatrists. It's sort of like wife abuse. I mean, the most stupid people about the effects of wife abuse or husband abuse or child abuse are the abusers.
Yeah.
Most stupid people about slavery in many ways were the slaveholders.
Right.
They knew enough to manipulate, control, and abuse, but that doesn't take knowledge. That takes a kind of brutality that has obvious effects and everybody knows about. But if you're abusing somebody, you don't want to understand them. If
right.
you're drugging them, lobotomizing them, shocking them, you don't want to understand them. In fact, you can't bear to understand them. You have to go through what I go through, what Mary Wheaton goes through. So psychiatrists are actually the stupidest people in the world when it comes to the effects of their drugs and their electroshock and their lobotomy.
Yes.
And I have found this. Mary, early in my career, I took on the entire lobotomy establishment, which I didn't realize was the medical establishment because they protect their own.
Mm-hmm.
So it was much worse than I anticipated, much more violence and hatred.
Yeah.
And it started at the very beginning with the violence and hatred before I was even talking about drugs or shock treatment, just on the lobotomy issue. And I was told by the assistant director of NIMH at the time, whom I'd known because I was a commissioned officer there and a full-time consultant, and I think my status was surgeon, something like that, or lieutenant commander.
Yeah.
And he said, you can't go up there. You're going to be debating these neurosurgeons, William Sweet, most powerful doctor in the country, the head of neurosurgery at Boston, at Mass General and Harvard. You can't debate these people, Peter. They'll eat you alive. Well, actually, they were duck soup. They're stupid. Yeah, William Sweet, all of you. They didn't know anything because they couldn't bear to follow up their patients. They could not bear to understand the damage they were doing to their patients. They had no idea what was going on.
Yeah.
And none of them did honorable follow-ups. I found that a book with an introduction from Sweet by two... a psychiatrist and a doctor, or Mark and Irvin, who they're a neurosurgeon and a psychiatrist affiliated with Harvard. They wrote a book, Violence in the Brain, and it was a lie. They took a patient who was actually really in good shape. They destroyed him and reversed the before and after.
Wow.
And I couldn't say that if it wasn't true.
Right.
And I wrote all about it and, spoke about it, and they don't know anything. So you go with the toughest problems in the world to some man or woman who's sitting in an office who, if you're lucky, the first time will spend a little time with you. Thereafter will make his living doing 10-minute follow-ups on patients and drugging them. Only way they make a living, what they consider a good living, is these tiny follow-ups. That's why they don't do psychotherapy. You can't make that kind of a several hundred thousand dollar income doing psychotherapy. Insurance coverage won't do it unless you're very famous and live in New York City or something, but you can't do it, basically. So they just do these drugs.
Right.
And so they end up knowing nothing. So you're going to the high priest of human knowledge, people think, the psychiatrist, who yeah. knows, who may read your mind. And he doesn't know anything about you before or after he's seen you.
Nope, nothing.
Oh, my God. I've never put it so eloquently.
It was great. You should write it down.
I'm going to add it to this blog I'm working on. Or maybe I'll write another one. I'm getting, you know what? I always got accused early on. Not anymore. I don't get accused of anything early on. They don't want to acknowledge my existence. They'd say, well, you know, you exaggerate and so on. So on and so forth for effect. And I'm saying, no, I'm dampening down for effect because the truth of the situation, well, as I'm getting older now, I'm actually speaking even more clearly and directly more often about the truth. The truth hasn't changed one whit. My earliest books were true. It's quite astonishing. I've never been cross-examined in court on my scientific papers and my books. Eli Lilly, when I went up against them, would try to do it in depo, and they couldn't do it. So I go to court, and I never got cross-examined on the science. Never. It's a pleasure to have you on. I feel like you're such a kindred spirit that it just enables me to really sort of talk maybe a little more. Maybe some of my people watching or listening will say, no, that's you, Peter. But I really think we have to confront. We're sending our most troubled people
yes.
to the most stupid practitioners on the face of the earth. You can't abuse and understand at the same time. You can't drug, shock, or lobotomize and understand at the same time. No human being is capable of that kind of inner conflict and cognitive dissonance.
Yes.
No slaveholder was deeply sympathetic toward the slaves. No Nazi deeply understanding of the Jews. No abuser. No drugger. I'm going to take a breath. We have about 10 minutes left. Talk some more about your favorite subject, if you wish, informed consent. It's really impossible, isn't it? Because no one who got informed consent on drugs would take them, really, if they understood it. Well, they might, in desperation, take them for 3 or 4 weeks, which is how long they're tested for, 5 or 6 weeks. They might. I don't think they would if they had adequate help. I don't think anybody who, with informed consent and adequate help, would do this unless they wanted to hurt themselves. And I've talked to people who got shock treatment and even took psych drugs because they were hateful toward themselves. Mm-hmm. And they kind of did it knowingly. One of my patients whom, we came off all the drugs that had shock treatment. And I think more than one said to me, I knew at the time I was hating myself and I didn't want to exist so much anymore. Do you see that? I don't think so in the military. I think these people are taking these drugs because they obey orders and they believe.
Yes, I think that's right. I do. And I think you're absolutely right. And I think that another element of informed consent is that the providers themselves are in no way prepared to provide the patient with informed consent. I think a lot of them don't know. I think a lot of my colleagues, especially primary care, where a lot of this medicine goes out the door,
They don't know at all. Neither do the psychiatrists. None of them know.
No, they don't. But I think even the ones who do know actually very arrogantly believe that they don't have to explain it to you, because if they did, you wouldn't take the medicine. And they know better than you do what needs to happen in your life. And they feel like they are empowered somehow to make a decision that to give you a drug that could kill you for an ailment or an emotion that never would. So, and they weigh those things in the balance. I mean, no one's ever died of anxiety, but people die from anxiety medicines every day. The arrogance that it takes to make that decision for a person without explaining to them that that's the case and letting them make the decision that their ailment is so much worse or it's worth risking death. They're just not prepared to tell them that that is where the balance is.
Right. How do you end up taking 6 hours on the subject? I guess you do it the way you said, by doing this comprehensive analysis of the history of psychiatry.
So
that's really what it takes. It takes, like, folks, this is a myth. These people don't know what they're doing.
Yeah. I have a beautiful PowerPoint presentation. It literally takes 6 hours to give it well. And I, you know, throw in a few jokes and, you know, make sure that I keep everybody engaged and happy. But I break it down to the level where someone with an eighth grade education can absolutely understand this. And, you know, and like I said, it's just about keeping people engaged and letting them know that they've got to have this information. They've got to have it.
Let me ask you a really tough question. Do you know of any disasters that have occurred as a result of your program?
No. We have had two people who graduated from our program pass away after they went through the program, but not related to the program in any way. So, no, I do not know of any disasters that have occurred. None have happened during the week, that's for sure. And all of the alumni, we keep track of them very well. So we're aware of their life afterwards.
Yeah. That's really, really good. And, you know, I've been in practice since 1968, and for most of my practice, 30, 40 hours a week, even when I was doing everything else, you know, I worked every day. Mm-hmm. And after Ginger joined me, we both worked every day for, you know, until we got up, until we went to bed, maybe spending a couple hours together to debrief. So I've had a very busy practice. No, so I worked with patients for 4 years and at Harvard College, and I was running the volunteer program and going in by myself on the wards. And I've never had a suicide. Now, I thank God for that genuinely, because that can happen to any good therapist.
Sure.
But I haven't had a suicide in my practice, never had any severe violence in my practice. And I think it's in part because I'm nonviolent. I'm not doing things harmful. I'm caring and loving. I give encouragement. I don't imply that if the therapy's not going well, it's your fault. You know, it's a joint process, and we do our best, and we're just folks working together and doing our best. I try to work with the families. And very few people who come to programs like yours or practices like yours or mine get worse. But I think that most of the patients routinely seeing psychiatrists get worse. And one way you can tell is that they're not on drugs when they come. And then in the beginning, they're on one drug usually, sometimes one or two. And then eventually they're on three or four, then the drugs are changed. So you know they're not getting better. And believe me, on the drugs, they're getting worse.
Yeah.
And my colleagues actually believe that, quote, mental illness is this, like, dementia, this disastrous disorder from which nobody recovers. None of us thought that when I was in my training in the 1960s. We didn't think that at all. We didn't think people stayed on drugs all their lives. We didn't think bipolar disorder was a prescription for drugs forever. We almost never saw bipolar disorder, by the way, people who were having manic episodes. And then, I mean, we saw three in my entire training who weren't drug-induced. Now almost everybody's bipolar because they're on bipolar drugs that make you bipolar.
Right.
It's so bad. It's so hard to even get it across, keep a serious face, because it makes me anxious to just think about how awful all this is. Any thoughts, parting words? It's really a pleasure to have you on. You actually inspire me to talk more, because I just know that you're a fighter too. And let me just thank you.
You're welcome. I have to thank you, because if I had never picked up your book, I don't think any of this would have ever happened.
Oh, God, thank you for that. You know, in my 80s, these are such kind words to hear, and they're wonderful. Not that I'm quitting, But, you know, when I was younger, I didn't even let myself hear these words. It was like, I don't know, I got work to do. I don't get soft. I don't want to feel loved. I got work to do.
Good for you.
You know, and we're all like that, I think, when we're young and we're reformers and we don't bask or bathe. We're too busy.
That's right.
To bask and bathe. But you'll get older and then you'll look back and you'll still be working like I am, but you'll bask a little more. You're doing wonderful, wonderful work. Have you thought about a book?
I have. It's already got a title and I'm halfway through it. So one of these days I'll finish it, maybe this summer.
Well, if I can help you in any way, I would be really delighted to do that. Have you tried to do any kind of a review article?
No.
Because I'd like to help you with that. And I know I'm on the editorial board of a few journals. And I mean, it would be very good for almost, for any journal, any good psychology journal or for the Journal of Risk and Safety in Medicine, because this is about risk and safety in medicine.
Yeah.
So let me inspire you at the end of the show to think about, we could do a joint article or you could just do something. Let's talk about it later. I want you to get out there into the professional arena some more, and I want to do whatever I can to do for you and your wonderful program. My wonderful audience, I hope you've enjoyed this. If you wonder what I do with moving my head, sometimes I'm looking down because I really like to look at my guests, and sometimes I'm looking at the camera, and I promise you I will move the camera and my guests nearer together as I grasp my technology. Thanks so much. And again, Mary Neal Vietan, V-I-E-T-E-N. Go to her website, learn about her, read about her, send her money, help her buy books, do everything in your power to help this wonderful, wonderful woman. This is the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour. Thank you all for listening. Watch me on TV, listen to the radio show, look at my website. We're all here to educate you.